morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Kim Kindersley, who has made a film called Whale Dreamers. He will be speaking to us from Australia. Right now, I would like to welcome John Bauermaster. He is a kayaker, filmmaker, and author of the book Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And so you have just been in Taos this past weekend showing your film at the Taos Film Festival. This was a film you decided to do something that I think nobody has ever thought of, namely sea kayaking down the coast of Vietnam.
Well, my passion is for investigating the lives of people who live and depend on the sea. And when we mounted this big 10-year-long project where the intention was to kayak around the world one continent at a time. And when I looked at the map of Asia, for whatever reason or reasons, Vietnam jumped out at me. And so, yeah, we started negotiating with the government in Hanoi to bring kayaks to Vietnam and kayak 800 miles down the coastline from the border of China down to Hoi An. My initial reasoning proved correct. We met hundreds, thousands of people every day. So we brought back lots and lots and lots of stories.
And some of those stories are in the book, some of them are in the movie. And you made the film for National Geographic. I mean, what was the idea of the film before you started it? And then how did that evolve as you actually started doing it and met people?
Well, as an American, I just felt like North Vietnam was a part of the world that, despite the fact that fighting had been over there, what, of course, the Vietnamese called the American War, had been over for 30 years, it was still a place that we as Americans didn't know very well, didn't understand, certainly not the north of Vietnam. So I wanted to go back and meet the people so that I could personally kind of replace the images of Vietnam that I had. I'd never been there before, which had come mostly from movies. You know, my images of Vietnam were mostly from Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter and Platoon and things like that, but those are false images. They're antique at this stage. So I wanted to replace those, both for myself and then, of course, because I took a photographer and a videographer, we were able to bring back great visuals to try and change the impressions that our readers and our viewers had as well.
So obviously the impressions that you have from movies like this were from the American soldier point of view, but you got to see the Vietnamese point of view talking about the American war. What did you find that the range of people's attitudes were toward Americans and toward this part of their history?
Well, we traveled for a couple months by kayak, and I really don't think we suffered one word of animosity, even though we were mostly Americans. One interesting thing I did was I knew I needed someone to travel with me who spoke the language, because obviously my Vietnamese is very poor, in fact non-existent. So I found a woman whose family had fled Vietnam on the last day of fighting in 1975. She, with her family, had come to the United States. She'd grown up in New Orleans. They continued to speak the language in the house. She'd been back to Vietnam several times. She wasn't a very experienced kayaker. In fact, she wasn't experienced at all. But she was so good on the other sides that I brought her along with us. And the fact that she was from the South and that we were traveling mostly in the North then became part of our adventure, part of our experience.
She's an interesting character. She was a self-described Vietnamese-American princess.
Yeah, a VAP.
A VAP.
Yeah. Of which apparently there are many. I mean, there are more resettled Vietnamese refugees in the United States than any other nationality, largely because I think the United States felt very guilty after the end of fighting and let a lot of refugees in.
And so there you were, this little crew of five people in, what, five separate kayaks?
Did
you have two-man kayaks?
No, we had three singles and one double.
And with cameras and gear and all this stuff. And presumably they hadn't seen a whole lot of kayaks.
No, they'd very rarely seen kayaks. But I will say, and this is true of all of our explorations of coastlines around the world, is when we arrive at these very remote places by boat, people are very accepting. These are people who spend most of their days in boats. They live on the edge of the sea. They assume everyone spends their time in boats. So they never once asked us, really, why are you here? They were very curious about why the boats were bright colors, what they were made of. They loved our bailing pumps because, of course, most of their boats leaked very badly.
Right.
We traded many, many pumps for rice wine. But the beauty of the kayaks was they really gave us access to parts of Vietnam that we would never have reached otherwise because we were arriving from the sea.
So there was no particular mission. It was just like, let's meet people, all kinds of people, all classes, all walks of life.
Yep, let's bring back a story of what Vietnam, particularly what we regard as North Vietnam, is like today, because I really felt that that was kind of an unknown. When I first went to Vietnam in 2000, I think there were about 700,000 tourists a year coming to Vietnam. Now, today, in 2008, 4 million. So it's become a boom industry.
And who are these tourists? Or where do they come from? What are they doing there?
Well, you know, a lot of Americans, a lot of Europeans, and I was there just 1 year ago this month, and you're seeing a lot of middle-class Chinese because it's very close and they have disposable income.
Right, right. And so what do tourists do when they go to Vietnam?
Well, the tricky part is, you know, I encourage people to go because it helps support the economy of Vietnam. It's a pretty poor country, but it's also a very small country, and it's also a communist country. So they do try and monitor where tourists go. And as a result, all of these now 4 million tourists a year are basically following and trotting in the same paths. So you know what happens on land when people follow the same paths. You get a kind of a rutted trail. And now the same thing is happening along the coastline because there are places, especially in Ha Long Bay in the north, which is very beautiful. There's 350 beautiful limestone islands rising straight out of the sea. That's what everyone wants to go and visit. But, of course, the boats that are carrying them now are all going. It's like a shuttle back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you can imagine the kind of trail of pollution, plastic bags, candy wrappers, fuel spills, etc.
Well, it's like probably many of the national parks here. The last time I went to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, it was like a tourist processing plant.
Yeah, no, it's not pretty. It's one of those places that I'm actually glad I saw previously, even though it was only 8 years ago, so things are changing very fast.
Very interesting.
But it's a dynamic country. I mean, you go to Hanoi, which is the capital of the country, which is where the seat of the communist government, and you feel like you're in a booming democracy. I mean, I've been there many times. I'm not convinced I've met a communist.
What is Hanoi like? Give us the feeling of that city.
Actually, I've traveled a bit around the world, and Hanoi is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, big cities. It's avoided that kind of tall glass skyscraper that dominates so many of the South Asian cities. It's all this kind of crumbling French architecture. There's only a couple, maybe one tall skyscraper within the city limits. So,
well, you talked in the book about how your favorite cities are cities planned by the French.
Yeah, Hanoi, obviously, Paris, and then Washington, D.C., largely because they're all based on circles and roundabouts that are built around a hub, kind of. And the other thing that all three of those cities have in common is in Washington, D.C., nothing can be built taller than the Capitol. In Paris, nothing can be built taller than the Sacré-Cœur. And in Hanoi, nothing can be built taller than Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum. So you have this incredible big open sky, similar to here in Santa Fe, that you see all the time in all those cities, which I think is great.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. His book is called Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam, with photography by Rob Howard, who's a marvelous photographer.
Yeah, I specifically took Rob on this trip because of his portraiture work. He's a great, great portrait photographer. And we also agreed that he would take primarily black and white photos of the people we met. And he carried a big Polaroid camera. The pictures that are in the book are primarily Polaroids.
Is that right?
Which meant that
I didn't know they still had those.
Yeah, which meant that he was exposing them and then developed them, processing them as we moved along, which has brought a whole new element of work to his days. And one of my reasons for pushing to publish these books is that I travel with really great photographers, and I hate that so often we come back from these trips and so many of their beautiful images just end up in a desk drawer and no one sees them.
So you say there's no real, you didn't meet any real communists. What is the stamp of communism? How do you see it, if you do, when you travel in Vietnam?
Well, I arrived as a journalist, so any journalist who comes to Vietnam needs the approval of the Foreign Press Center. And no matter if you're working for the Hoboken News or the Food Channel or the National Geographic, as I do, you must agree to be followed, accompanied by a government-supplied monitor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is true in our case as well. And that person that they assigned to us became part of our adventure. His name was Lynn. He was perfect for our trip because he was not a big fan of water. I'm not convinced he could swim.
You had him in a kayak?
Well, his goal was to follow us, so he would hire small boats or big boats or monitor us from land if he could through binoculars. And I would say to him on many, many occasions, well, I would ask him, why do you feel a need to accompany us, follow us? And he would say, well, I'm here only to make sure you meet people who tell the truth.
The truth police.
Yeah, and I would say, I would follow up and ask, well, how do you identify them? How can you tell? And what we assessed was, you know, in a country of 85 million people, 75 million are Buddhist, 10 million are Catholic. And they seemed, the government and their emissary Lynn, seemed to be most concerned whenever we would arrive by kayak in a small Catholic community, which we wouldn't really know in advance until we kind of rounded a curve or pulled up on the beach and saw a church steeple with a cross on it, and then we would know we were in a Catholic town.
And so they were suspicious of Catholics?
Very, very, yeah.
Why, because they could lie and then confess on Sunday?
No, they believed that the Catholic Church, which is pretty well organized, is one place that could foment protest if there were to be a protest. And we talked to many, many people kind of in hidden corners in a way, because they really did follow us when we were interviewing people. And they would, if we were arriving in a Catholic community, for example, Lynn would have called ahead to alert the local party officials so that they would turn out as well to greet us, so that anyone we met was now just not just meeting us, but they were meeting us accompanied by a phalanx of local party people. So they were very intimidated. And in the end, because we did have some conversations with them outside of the earshot of the monitors, you know, what they had to complain about were basically the same things people around the world complain about. They want better jobs and better pay. They want better education for their kids. They want better health care. You know, there was no one we met who was plotting to overthrow the government in
right.
Hanoi.
So the main way that you encountered communism was through the government telling you what you couldn't do. I love this term that kept on coming up, which was you can't go to certain places because of military sensitivities, which is the ultimate oxymoron.
Right, and we were there just on the heels of a visit by Bill and Hillary Clinton in the waning days of Clinton's presidency, and they'd had some very severe flooding in that springtime. And so President Clinton had brought along satellite images taken by a U.S. satellite that showed the entire coastline of Vietnam. And he presented this to the Vietnamese government because they didn't have them. And, of course, in those satellite imagery was every military base, every little outpost that the government had. So for them, for the government of Vietnam to suggest that we might expose military secrets was silly from our kayaks. What are we going to do with one still camera and a video camera?
But in terms of the populace, in terms of the regular people, was there a sense that either communist ideology, way of life, economics had made them who they are?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a place that knows freedom of speech or freedom of press. Not at all. And they allow freedom of religion only in that they do allow the Catholics to exist there, which is a hangover from the French days, when the French were there in the 50s and 40s and 30s. But the way we sought evidence was that people would tell us that if you're in a room with five Vietnamese people, guaranteed one of them is a government informant, guaranteed. Now, whether that's true or not, it's hard to tell, but that's what they believe. And so that everyone's very cautious of what they say.
Right.
And so as a result, because we're storytellers, we've got big cameras, and we're asking them to tell us truths, you know, it starts to shape the questions we ask. We had a very...
In what way? Explain more about that.
Well, we had a very open conversation, for example, with three men in their 40s who were fishermen, but pretty prosperous fishermen. We just crossed the border of what would have been South Vietnam if the border still existed. And they told us the story of kind of a new booming economy in Vietnam, which was the marrying off of sisters, aunts, nieces, two outsiders, you know, from Australia, Europe, United States, in which Vietnamese families would pay $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 for one of these outside men to come in, marry one of their nieces, daughters, sisters,
females,
take them back to their country, and then, you know, agree to a divorce, you know, 6 months or a year later or something. And they told us this story very openly.
Wait, who was paying who? Who was making money?
The families in Vietnam were paying the outsiders to come in.
And what did they get out of it?
$25,000. So I'm a white American man. I come to Vietnam.
So the American is paying.
No. The Vietnam family is paying me $25,000 to marry their sister,
uh-huh,
and take her back to the U.S.
And then get divorced. I don't understand. What's the?
Well, she gets to live in. She gets to stay in the United States
for 6 months.
No. Then she's there.
Oh, I see.
So
it's basically buying her citizenship or
exactly.
green card elsewhere.
I've gotten her out of the country for $25,000.
Right. Where do they come up with that kind of money?
Well. The extended families. The end of that story was, though, that they then said to us after being interviewed on the video cameras, that they said, well, of course, if you use that story in your film, if you tell that story, we'll go to jail. You'll never know it. You'll be gone. You'll never, you know, we'll never see you again. We'll be in jail, and you won't know.
So did you tell it in the documentary?
No, we didn't. Absolutely
but you're
not.
Telling it here. We hope that the Vietnamese security service isn't listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
No pictures or attached
right.
to it. But the reality was that I'm not sure that they really would have ended up in jail or not, but that's that level of intimidation that comes with a society that doesn't believe in freedom of speech.
So there's a tourist industry and there's a very big fishing industry. What's that like?
Well, you know, 25 million of those 85 million people are depend on fishing as their livelihood. So as we worked our way down the coast, almost every stop we would hang out with fishermen. And very kind of rudimentary. The men go out in big wooden boats two or sometimes three times a day, and then the women wait on shore and are basically the business managers. As soon as the men come back, they offload they hand the fish over to their wives, spouses, mothers, etc., and then the women do the weighing, the selling, the distribution of the fish. They believe that having a woman on the fishing boat is very superstitious, very bad luck. So the women, there are no women fishermen, except in instances where mom and pop might go out and do the fishing,
right.
But on the bigger boats, there are no women on the boats.
So are they dealing with the same problems that everybody else is, namely pollution and depletion of their fish stocks?
The depletion of the fish stocks, not so bad yet. The South China Sea seems to be pretty hardy. Of course, they're getting big pressure from the Chinese. And the Chinese are the first to remind the Vietnamese that it's called the South China Sea, not the South Vietnamese Sea. So they're trying to come in and grab everything they can, both in the fishing level, but also in oil and other minerals, which are in the seabed. No, the biggest problem is pollution. We pulled into one bay in Ha Long Bay called Cat Ba, where there were 5,000 people living on boats in one harbor, basically. That's a lot of people sharing a pretty small body of water. And you can imagine the pollution resulting from lack of sanitation, fuel spills, etc. in that bay. Some guy, very sweet guy, I paddled up to the back of his boat, and he thought he was doing me a favor because he went to pick the bow of my kayak up onto his boat, which of course then spilled me into this bay, and they were in a panic because they never go in that water, and they immediately insisted I get out and jump in a barrel of rainwater to get whatever this was in the water off of me.
Did you have any scungy yuckers on you after that was done?
I survived. No, we've had pretty good luck. We've been traveling around the world on different waterways for a decade, and fingers crossed, no scungies.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. So you met so many people. Who are some of the most memorable people you met, and tell us their stories?
Well, you know, one of the themes that I had not anticipated was this theme of escape. Virtually everyone we met had a story of trying to escape or having a member of their family escape. I knew that we would hear those stories in the South because at the end of fighting in 1975, many of the Southerners tried to escape because they knew that, you know, their retribution and re-education camps were going to come. But what amazed us was that in the North, virtually everyone had tried to escape as well, because after the war, the Americans put a very stiff embargo on the country and really drove it deep into poverty. So even though they were the vanquishers, even though they'd won, everybody wanted out. And so as we paddled along the coast, we would, in certain areas, especially where there was a little barrier island or something, we would paddle up and we would meet the poorest of crab fishing families. You know, extended families of 15 living basically in a little stilted shack. No money, not enough money to send their kids to school, anything like that. And right next door would be a, you know, by comparison, a beautiful home with tile floor and ceiling fans and electricity and boom boxes. And it was because that family had had someone from it successfully escape. They'd get out to Hainan Island and over to Hong Kong and then off to Australia, Europe, Canada, the United States. Once they'd done that, they were able to get a job working at Kinko's, working for landscape architecture, whatever their jobs, and send money back. And that is another boom economy on top of tourism that is supporting Vietnam now, is all this money coming back from outside into Vietnam.
It's such a funny thing. People doing jobs that when Americans do them, they're in debt, and when people from other countries do them, they're actually supporting not only themselves but other families.
Yeah, no, it was interesting every day, and even though it sounds cliche, I mean, we really were meeting people, especially on the islands off the coast, who had never met a Westerner, never seen an American. If they had seen an American, probably was a soldier in a uniform with a big gun. And that's why we traveled in a kind of a softer way. We were a team of five, three men and two women. And I included women as part of the team purposefully so that we would present ourselves as a softer image than they might have had.
Softer, gentler, and not be five American burly white guys,
yeah, five,
showing
eight.
Up on shore and
exactly.
Bringing back flashbacks.
Exactly.
You said at the beginning of the book that you wanted to see how, sort of open yourself and see how Vietnam would change you. Looking back, how do you feel that it did, if it did?
Well, one thing was that we here in the States come from a pretty privileged place. You know, we have the luxury of wealth relative to the rest of the world, which gives us this kind of weird opportunity to constantly be looking back at history and kind of trying to reassess history, particularly in this case, the Vietnam War. I mean, still today you'll hear people debating the rights and wrongs of a war that's now been over for 33 years. In Vietnam, we met none of that. I mean, they almost never brought up the subject of war, and it's largely because they're very poor, you know, and they're looking towards tomorrow and the future. They don't have that luxury of being able to sit in navel gaze and look backwards. And
although I have to say, I mean, there's other poor people around the world who are looking back, and, you know, the person across the river 500 years ago did something to us, and they're still remembering it.
Yeah, maybe ancestrally, but not culturally, and not based on current events. And I actually kind of admired that. The other part was that in of course, since with anyone who travels, I mean, you're constantly amazed and surprised at how open people are. I mean, everyone invited us into their homes. And one of the things that we saw in every home, whether it was Buddhist or Catholic, were their family altars. In Vietnam, like many Asian cultures, they celebrate not people's birthdays, but people's death anniversaries. So they keep these altars in remembrance of the relatives of theirs who have passed. It's a very prominent place in a person's home. They're very open to sharing it, but if they do share it with you, it's a very, very powerful thing. And I liked that kind of sense of family that we met, which, you know, again, in the States, you don't see as often.
So now you're back, and you're going around the country showing the film?
Well, we're showing the film. We have this beautiful new book out, published by National Geographic. And also, you know, it's the end of this 10-year-long project, this Oceans 8 project, that has taken us around the world one continent at a time.
It's the end of it?
Yeah.
You've run out of continents?
We've run out of continents, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's where the Oceans 8 comes from, 7 continents plus
right.
Oceania. So 8 different expeditions using sea kayaks as these kind of ambassadors to get us to places we couldn't get otherwise, to introduce us to people from kind of a peer level, a sea level. And it worked. You know, we really, I think we have this now this unique look at both the health of the world seas and what it's like for people who live and depend on the sea around the world.
So what's next for you?
Well, you know, we're going to continue the same storytelling, same subject matter. I don't think we'll be taking kayaks so much. But these stories of relationship between man and the sea. Since we've returned from Antarctica, we're editing that film, but we've already gone and shot new films in the Galapagos and also in southern Louisiana. And if you've been to southern Louisiana, you know that everyone who lives there has an integral relationship with water because it's everywhere. Swamps, bayous, rivers, creeks, the Mississippi, the Gulf of Mexico. So it was a fascinating subject matter for us, largely because people don't just, they don't live there as neighbors. They don't live there for leisure reasons. They live there because they depend on these waterways. So it was perfect for us.
Well, we look forward to having you on the air if you come through Santa Fe again and talking about your next project. John Bauermaster is the author of Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam, and he just showed his film, was it of the same name?
Yep, Descending the Dragon.
At the Taos Film Festival. So we want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And we're going to be talking more about people's relationship to water when we talk about the film Whale Dreamers in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to introduce Kim Kindersley. He is the writer and director of the award-winning film Whale Dreamers, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Center. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hello there.
It's great to have you on the air. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your own story, how you left a successful career and a comfortable life and ended up in Australia involved with dolphins and whales and people from the Aboriginal Murning tribe.
Well, you know, it sort of goes into it a little bit in the film, but I was sort of merrily going along my way and living in London, being an actor and going to auditions and appearing in TV series and films and adverts and plays and doing all that kind of thing. And I was sort of vaguely heading towards Hollywood, I suppose. I was just at that point of kind of breaking through along with all the Hugh Grants and everybody. And I went on a trip to Ireland because that's where my family's from and visited my uncles and cousins and so on. And I went to a fishing village called Dingle Bay where I'd heard there was this lone hermit dolphin, which is a dolphin that leaves the pod and goes and hangs out with human beings. I was only intrigued. I mean, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do, but I had no expectation of anything dramatic happened. And how wrong was I? I mean, I went out on the ocean and this dolphin came up to our boat and leapt out of the water, and I got into the water and he swam very fast towards me, and it was freezing kind of Atlantic water, very murky. He came very close to me and turned around and then looked at me with this eye of his, and it was just like this moment where everything that I'd been taught and the whole of my life completely changed in that moment, because I kind of felt I was one with everything and that I hadn't really been taught that we live in balance with nature and that kind of thing. So it set me on a path to start seeking out mythologies around whales and dolphins, and obviously that led me to tribal people, firstly in America, actually with the Chumash Indians in California. And in fact, one of the first big dolphin events I ever went to was in Santa Fe in 1992. It was a dolphin symposium called together by Scott Taylor and Francis Huxley was there, all sorts of extraordinary people. Anyway, eventually the trail led through Hawaii and then down to Australia, where there's a fellow here called Peter Shenstone, who had channeled in the 70s and 80s a thing called The Legend of the Golden Dolphin, which speaks of the end times and the time of the end of the system of things, which is now. And this dolphin spirit called Cui Long, and that led me again to this tribe in the south called the Murning, who'd actually seen a promo video I'd put together with an actor friend of mine called John Hurt, because I was working on a film at the time called Eyes of the Soul with Julian Lennon. And then one thing led to another, and I became completely intrigued by their story because it was so human. Apart from all the magical stuff going on with the whales, they'd been declared extinct by the government in 1957. And there I was sitting with these amazing people on their land in the, you know, which is very, very remote, and with these stunning whale rocks and this incredible culture around the whale, their totem animal. with beautiful songs, but just really only a slither of their culture remaining. And I thought, wow, this is a story that should be told to the world, because this is our story. You know, we're headed towards extinction if we don't wake up in time. So let's share this with the world. And they had a prophecy around the coming of a white whale called Jiddera, who's their creation spirit, who came at the beginning of time and created the land and the sea and the air. And so we called together a huge group of indigenous people from all over the planet. And that was really the beginning of the film that you see now.
What does the term whale dreaming, the title of the film is Whale Dreamers, what is whale dreaming? What does that mean? It's a specific thing.
Well, it's a very big subject, the dreaming in Australia, but to put it in the simplest way that I can, it is a poetic way of interacting with your ancestors, your history, your environment, the cosmos, and through it you find your place in it. And so, for example, talking of whale dreaming, the Murning, who live by the coast, so they're coastal people, would have had a long history of sharing ceremony with the whales. They feel that they eat the same food, so they eat shellfish off the reefs while the whales are coming in to rest and feed and so on. And then they would sing with the whales, and they believe they came from the whales, that to the whales they would return. So it's a way, in a way, of sort of interpreting where you are in the universe. And also, through the dreaming, you co-create the future. There's been a lot of kind of talk in the last few years of the powers of manifestation. I suppose The Secret, in a way, is a film all about that. But the dreaming, and through the dreaming, is the way that you co-create with the whole of nature and the universe and the cosmos, in a way, what's going to happen next, taking into account where you live and from whence you've come.
And so when you have a group like the Murning people who are displaced, they're taken away from the sea by the Australian government, are they robbed of their ability to participate in that activity, that dreaming?
Well, this is the really key question. And, you know, for all people who are seekers of the truth, you know, it's like for the Aboriginal people, they feel that it's really important to be on the traditional land because it kind of anchors you. And it's from that place that everything else kind of evolves. You know, it's where you get your water, it's where you conceive, it's where you give birth, it's where you live your life. And you know the land so intimately. You know where the fruit is at certain times of year. You know where to go to get water when it's in the drought season and so on and so on. You know which cave to go into when the stars are in a certain alignment, which will create a certain kind of energy in a ceremony. And if you take that away, which, of course, they were all displaced and they were sent to work as servants in a thing called what is now known as the Great Australian Silence. And it's a very familiar story all around the world, including the U.S., with Native peoples, First Peoples being displaced and sent away from their traditional hunting lands and so on. Then it does create a massive problem. But having said that, we also all know that inside of us is everything as well. And I think that this is a realization that's also happening, that you know, the dreaming also exists within the heart of every human being. And you can also, in a way, connect with your land even if you're not there in the heart. But essentially, for Aboriginal people, it's very, very difficult to practice culture because the culture is so interwoven from where you're from.
We're talking to Kim Kindersley about his film, Whale Dreamers. So you brought together indigenous people, indigenous elders from all over the planet to Australia. This is documented in the film. And they're all people who have a relationship of one kind or another to whales, to dolphins, to the sea. What was the purpose of the gathering?
It was a very natural process. At about the third year, the third visit I did with the Merning onto their land, and, you know, each visit we went deeper into, for example, on the third visit we went to this whale graveyard, and along the south coast a lot of whaling stations. So one of the things that happened to the Merning before they were declared extinct was they witnessed the massive slaughter of literally thousands and thousands of their sacred animals and could do absolutely nothing about it. And all the bones that were left over from the carcasses of the whales were stored in this one place. And gradually, you know, over the years, they would do ceremonies in each rib cage of the whale. I was so moved by the energy of this place and the sadness. And, you know, they were explaining to me that the whole of Western civilization was built on the back of killing whales, which is the most sacred animal, not only to them, but to the Zulus. The same in Zulu, the word for God and whale are the same word. And, you know, it's such a sort of indication of where our culture has come from in the last 200 or 300 years, since the Industrial Revolution just sort of blindly slashing and burning the whole planet to, you know, to so-called improve our civilization. And it was this moment that when they said, by the way, the white whale's been born, and this is a prophecy that we would start singing and dancing the whale songs again, and, you know, and bring the world back into balance, which is actually a very common prophecy with indigenous people. You could look at the white buffalo prophecies and the white whale, white dolphin, white ravens for the Haida people. And because I'd been around the world doing all of this research and had met a lot of elders and other indigenous people, I suggested, well, would you like me to try and, you know, raise the money and call some people in to bear witness to your return to this sacred space? And they charged me with that job, and for me and a couple of friends of mine, we started to try and raise the money to bring these indigenous elders from Hawaii and New Zealand, that was Pauline Tangiora, and various other people, including even Ua tribesmen from the Colombian jungles, who don't actually have a connection to the sea, but their story so potent, and because they were living in a traditional way, it felt important that they could be there. And so we went about the task, and I think we were about 6 hours away from the deadline of having to raise the money to allow this to happen, and we still only had 30,000 of the 400,000 that we needed. And a dear friend of mine was in the house in Malibu and said, well, I really don't know what we're going to do about this, and went upstairs to meditate on the roof of the house. And at that moment, a red-tailed hawk flew down and picked up a rattlesnake, flew it right above her head, and she decided that she would fund the whole thing herself through the Foundation Heart Magic. And that's how the gathering actually ended up happening, and people came from all over the world, and of course it's documented in the film.
Once this whole group gathering finally came together, one of the great ironies was that the Australian government would let the Merning people go back to their ancestral homelands that they'd been kicked off of, only under the condition that they promised not to do any kind of ceremony. What was that about? What did you think was going to happen?
It was one of the strangest things about the whole process. It's like, you know, you have people that flew in from all over the world. And then, you know, we're sitting with the traditional council of the group of people who represent the government and everything on the land that was the Mernings. And they said, sure, you can go down to the sacred space down there, but as you rightly say, as long as there's no ceremony. Now, can you imagine? Can you imagine being with, you know, 80 indigenous people going to a sacred place and saying to them, sorry, no prayers, no this, no that, no offerings? So, of course, we got down there, and, in fact, the first thing, the tobacco came out. People were doing it very discreetly under their breaths, and rattles were coming out, and, you know, and it was one of those things where actually it was going on. But then the thing that really, if you like, for me, cemented the beauty of ceremony but also got us thrown off the place was when Pauline Tangiora sent out a karanga, which is a prayer to the whale spirit, it was a really beautiful moment, but within about 5 minutes, the spokesperson for the Anangu came up to us and said, you've got to leave now. So we had to leave, and it was so the whole thing was cut short. But it, for me, it shows, you know, it's very indicative of the times we're living in. I think that, you know, that the mainstream and the kind of power paradigm that's controlling the planet is very, very scared of us really reconnecting with nature and coming back into that absolutely true balance with the natural world. And for me, that's what was represented on that day, was the absolute magic and beauty of who we are when we're in our sort of our natural ceremonial ritualistic state with nature. And but anyway, we carry it in our hearts to this day, that moment.
It does bring up issues that are really fascinating to the viewer, which is, what is the effect of ceremony on the people who do it, on the world, on that reconnection? Are you actually moving greater energies around? I mean, there is a kind of mystical sense to it that, people who haven't experienced that themselves don't know quite what to make of it. How did you actually experience it?
It's a really good question, because it's so funny. Some people see the film, and I promise you, they don't. All of what you've just said completely goes over their head, and it's like they're kind of saying to me, "But where's the narrative? There's not enough narrative. I want to know more about what did they have for breakfast." And, you know, they want to know all the kind of really sort of surface stuff. Where as what you're describing is entirely experiential. And so, you know, for me to describe what it is or how it feels is difficult, because I suppose it's different for every person. But I can give you a little, I try and give you an understanding of it from my perspective anyway. I mean, I've done a lot of ceremony with the Elko people. And so it starts off where you're creating sacred space, so you're purifying yourself with smoke, with the leaves in the fire, and that's sort of clearing your energetic field, if you like, of anything that shouldn't be there. And so you're then entering into the sacred space, which could be a circle, and you're setting an intention. And again, to put it in terms of, you know, the power of manifestation, I don't think human beings understand just how powerful we are when we really set an intention. Which is why, you know, on the surface, everything may look hopeless out there, you know, with what's going on in the world. But actually, it's not at all, because if enough of us can wake up to the reality of who we are, we can change this paradigm so fast, so quickly, just by intending it, just by pure intention in the heart. So for me, when we go into ceremony, and, you know, and I can be in a kind of, oh, I'm a bit tired, I've been working on this for years, I don't really feel like it on the day. But the moment it starts happening and you hear the sacred songs, because that's often a part of ceremony, chanting, and you realize that the chants have been sung by the Aborigines maybe for 60,000 years. And so something comes in, and, you know, a greater force comes into the circle of people. And then you just get goosebumps all over your body. You feel your heart opening. And you also feel completely at one with everybody, even though there are people there whose languages you don't speak or their cultures you don't know or understand. It's in that space that some really serious magic happens. And I think that the fact that we're even having this talk on the radio, for me anyway, indicates, you know, well, what were we doing on that bite for that week with all of those people doing those ceremonies? Was it just for us? Did it have any effect in the world? Well, it is having an effect in the world, because people are watching the film and raising questions just like the one you just did. So for me, look, we haven't made billions of dollars at the box office, and we live in a horribly commercial world where seemingly the only thing that's important is the bottom line and money, where in fact it's the least important thing. And the most important thing, in my view, is what we're talking about, which is real, which is magical, which is our birthright, which goes beyond all the religions. And it's in that space that I believe the hope lies for humanity.
We're talking to Kim Kindersley. The film is called Whale Dreamers. I felt when I was watching it, and I don't know if this was just me or not, but I felt that there was kind of a tension between the depth of the subject, which you're talking about now, namely the deep connections among people and animals and the earth and the ocean on the one hand, and then the very different pace and feeling of making a documentary and dealing with money and cameras and crews and fundraising. And then I look at the website and there's these like little cute blonde starlets advertising the film, and it just seems like there's a tension there. How do you, is that true? How do you work with that?
Oh, you know, hey, that's another whole subject, but look, it's out there now. But no, it's unbelievable. It's beyond belief, the particularly the money side of it. It's so hard to get anybody to commit to something like this because they're worried that it's not going to make money, that there isn't an audience and all the rest of it. And so that was a constant challenge. But we were incredibly lucky in having, firstly, the person that put up the money for the gathering through a non-profit. We really put her money where her heart is, which is fantastic and rare. And then we had Julian Lennon, who, you know, John's son, who has a little bit of personal wealth, obviously, and he again felt that it was really important, knowing that, you know, the typical corporate media would not get behind something like this. And so he started to bankroll it. Unfortunately, he didn't realize how long it would take us. And it did end up costing, you know, well over $1 million. But most of it was just blood, sweat, and tears. You know, long hours in the studio with editors and people doing deferred fees. And, I mean, I can't even tell you, just incredible people, cameramen, and who gave their time, and just communities who put on events and gather, you know, just it. There are no words to describe the amazing amount of input from so many people. And then, of course, you get to the end of that particular cycle, and then you try and get distribution. And then that's another whole story where the doors are just closed. Oh, sorry, we had a documentary in here last week with Leonardo DiCaprio called 11th Hour. It didn't do very good numbers, so we're just not going to do it. But we've got, don't worry, we've got plenty of comic book superhero movies coming out where they go and kill lots of baddies, you know, who happen to be Middle Eastern or whatever it is. But, you know, it's deeply depressing, the movie industry, and a very, very poor reflection on who we are, I think. Very, very sad story. But, look, we keep chipping away, and, you know, the more projects like this that can be made, in my view, I believe it's really important. And on that note, there's a fantastic company in America called Monterey Media. You know, they saw the film, they realized that it had some depth, and they, you know, courageously took it on. And said, I can't say enough good things about them, actually. They're an amazing group of people. They really care, and they make huge effort. And that's why I'm talking to you today. If it wasn't for them, you know, we'd be sort of straight to DVD and just selling from the website. So,
that's right.
You know, there are a few people out there that care. And, of course, the other great group is the Spiritual Cinema Circle. They're a fantastic organization. And you probably know others as well that are doing great work in this area. So there's plenty of hope here.
Kim Kindersley is the writer and director of the award-winning, many, many award-winning film, Whale Dreamers, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Center. You can find out more about it at whaledreamers.com. Thank you so much for being with us, Kim Kindersley, on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
And listen, thank you so much for having me, and I do hope that the viewers out there, rather the viewers, the listeners, have fun when they go and see the film, and look forward to getting some feedback and coming to Santa Fe again soon.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.